When most Westerners think of Ethiopia, no doubt their mind goes to images like this and the memory of Bob Geldof raising money in the mid-1980s for Live Aid. What is not often mentioned is that from 1974 to 1991, Ethiopia was under a brutal communist dictatorship, explicitly Marxist-Leninist in ideology and methods, called the Derg. Although the Derg would have several leaders in its early years, by 1977, this man, Mengistu Haile Mariam, generally just called Mengistu, had outmaneuvered his rivals and consolidated his power. In this video, I'm going to have a look at his economic policies and their effect during this period. With the assistance of the Soviet Union, the Derg overthrew the old emperor, Haile Selassie, in 1974. Selassie had ruled the country since 1916 and became internationally famous after occupation by Mussolini's fascist Italy in 1935. Ethiopia, also known as Abyssinia, had had contact with Europe going back centuries to the ancient world. It is a resource-rich country with fertile soil and good rainfall. By the 19th century, coffee had emerged as an important cash crop for the country. Ethiopia also historically traded wheat, corn, millet, gold, ivory, musk, and wild animal skins. It had long raised cattle and sheep also. However, it was never a great trading nation because of local hostility to commerce. The people tended to despise merchants and traders and looked instead to priests and warriors as their leaders. This was quite deep-rooted, to the extent that even after World War II, most of Ethiopia was still a barter economy because only a tiny fraction of the population actually used money. Wage labour was limited, economic units were largely self-sufficient, foreign trade was negligible, and the market for manufactured goods was extremely small. This had other knock-on effects. For example, it was very hard for Selassie's government to collect taxes, and they had to rely on customs, excise, and sales to generate revenue. As late as the 1970s, import tariffs accounted for over a third of government revenues and two-fifths of all taxes. In the 1950s, Selassie had wanted to transition from a subsistence agricultural economy, in which most people raised their own livestock, to a more agro-industrial one. Between 1957 and 1973, he launched three consecutive five-year plans to try to achieve this. Although they did not fully modernize the economy, they were a moderate success, achieving an average of 4.4% annual GDP per capita growth from 1960 to 1970. Manufacturing growth doubled from 1.9% in 1960 to 4.4% in 1973. And the growth rate for the wholesale, retail trade and transportation and communication sectors increased from 9.3% to 15.6%. Regionally, this economic performance was better than Sudan, which had an annual growth rate of 1.9%, but not as good as Kenya's 6% GDP growth or Uganda's 5.6% growth. By the early 70s, the economy had started to diversify a little bit, but four-fifths of the country's population were still subsistence farmers who lived in poverty because they used most of their meager production to pay taxes, rents, debt payments, and bribes. And during this whole period, Ethiopia ran a trade deficit. That is, it imported more than it exported. This can be fine for a developed, cash-rich country like the UK, but generally speaking, developing countries grow through exporting more than they import. So, when the communists took over, the Derg inherited a mostly agricultural peasant economy with a very small urban industrial population. Over 80% of the population were still peasant farmers. In fact, most of Ethiopia was practically a feudal economy. Aristocrats and the church owned most of the land. Peasant farmers paid them exorbitant rents. There was practically no business enterprise beyond this to speak of for at least 4/5 of the population. So when they took power in January of 1975, the Derg immediately nationalised or took partial control of over 100 companies, including banks and other financial institutions and insurance companies. Then, in March 1975, they nationalised all rural land and granted the peasants possessing rights to parcels of land around 10 hectares each. These land reform measures are often called villagisation, and they were a vast resettlement programme. By 1989, more than 13 million people were said to have been villagised. The 1975 Land Reform Proclamation stated that the government shall have the responsibility to settle peasants or to establish cottage industries to accommodate those who, as a result of distribution of land, remain with little or no land. Essentially, this policy was very similar to the Soviet Union's collectivization of farms. Disparate peasants who were scattered around rural areas were rounded up and forced into villages, which some at the time compared to Hitler's concentration camps. Farmers were often moved during the planting and harvesting seasons. There were predictably disastrous results, which I will discuss soon. In December 1975, they issued Proclamation 76, which put a 500,000 Burr, that's just under 20,000 1975 US dollars, price ceiling on private investment, and urged Ethiopians to invest in enterprises larger than cottage industries. They introduced rural land use fee and tax on income from agricultural activities to replace the old feudal tax system. They delegated collection of these taxes to peasant associations. But right until the very end of the regime, practical problems with actually collecting taxes from these rural areas persisted. They also put a 2% tax on exports and 19% tariffs on all imports. Luxury goods and certain other consumer goods were subject to high sales taxes. In a bid to curb inflation, they also instituted price controls, used the newly nationalized bank officially to overvalue the birr, and froze wages of government staff on more than 600 birr a month. That's around 21 US dollars. So that was a freeze for basically most of the government staff. Later in 1987, Mengistu would establish a new constitution that would retroactively legalize all of these changes with the decree, Article 2 in the constitution, which declared that the state shall guide the economic and social activities of the country through a central plan. So what were the effects of all of this? Well, from 1974 to 78, they were mostly engaged in a civil war, and growth plummeted to 0.4%. The K-Shabur, or Ethiopian Red Terror, modelled on the Soviet terror — the Derg were not just Leninists, they frequently quoted Stalin as well — ravaged the country until 1977. During this time, they killed anywhere between 30,000 and 750,000 people. Then there was the matter of the Ogaden War with Somalia, which took place between 1977 and 1978. During this time, prices experienced a 16.5% annual increase, and the national deficit widened because a lot of money was being spent on military supplies. From 1978 to 1980, GDP grew at an average annual rate of 5.7%, benefiting from good weather. Agricultural production increased at an average annual rate of 3.6%, and manufacturing increased at an average annual rate of 8.9%, as many closed plants, particularly in Eritrea, reopened. The current account deficit and overall fiscal deficit remained below 5% of GDP during this period, But all of this relatively rosy stuff between 78 and 80 can largely be explained as returning to something resembling normality after a period of revolution, civil unrest, and violent conflict. However, as soon as we adjust for peacetime, the next fiscal year, 1980 to 1981, shows a decline in GDP growth. In fact, GDP growth declined every year from 1980 to 1985, apart from 82 to 83. And then the economy stagnated between 1985 and 1990. The unemployment rate increased from 11.5% annually from 1979 to 1988. It is estimated that of the rural population, around 50% of the workforce were unpaid family workers. Real wages dropped. For example, the starting salary of a science graduate in 1975 was 600 birr. By 1984, they received only 239 birr. In 1975, the maximum salary for a civil servant was 1,440 birr. In 1984, this had dropped to 573 birr. The average real money wages of an industrial worker in 1986 was 65.6% of the 1975 rate. As these real wages decreased, consumer prices rose. The real price index shows a 27% increase from 1980 to 1987, with food prices increasing 27%, household items 38%, and transportation 17%. When wages fall and prices rise, that is called a decrease in the standard of living. Agricultural production dropped 2.1% a year from 1980 to 1987, while the population grew by 2.4% a year. It is not hard to see from just these two numbers why there was a famine which killed over a million people from 1984 to 1986. State farms accounted for 43% of government expenditure on agriculture, but accounted for only 6% of agricultural output in 1987. The peasant farmers were still responsible for over 90% of output. In fact, so catastrophic were these results that on the 5th of March 1990, in a speech to the Workers' Party of Ethiopia Central Committee, sensationally renounced communism. He admitted that the Marxist-Leninist economic plan from 1974 to 1990 had utterly failed and announced a new strategy in which planning would be decentralized. Ethiopia was to embrace the free market and pursue a mixed economy in which the private and public sectors would play complementary roles. This was partly because the Soviet Union had withdrawn support for the Derg, and the following year, Mengistu would be overthrown, fleeing to Zimbabwe, where Robert Mugabe granted him political asylum as an official guest. It's possible he killed over 2 million people during his brutal regime, not including those who died of famine. And as far as I know, he's still living there in Zimbabwe now. So what about those land reforms? 5.5% of the peasants died of starvation or disease. 14% simply fled. Now, while Ethiopia did experience a severe drought in 1984, it strikes me that wide-scale famine, which killed over a million people and affected about 8 million more, were as much to do with these brutal reforms as they were to do with the weather. The same thing happened in the Ukraine in the 1930s, in China in the late 1950s, where over 30 million people died of famine, in North Korea in the late 1990s, and in Zimbabwe in the 2000s. Which of them was real socialism, I ask you? Of all the terrible policies I've been reviewing in this series so far, it seems to me that the lethal combination of land reform with price controls on food consistently has the most devastating results. As they say, those who don't learn from history are destined to repeat it. Now get out.
And a very special thanks too Sir Percy Blakeney, The Crimson Satyr, The Ambivalent Onion, Andy Swainson, Bailey in Aurora, David Verscherche, Christopher Scholholm, Natural Rights, Binary Surfer, Holy Spatula, Hornito Jones, Kazga, Michael Tynan, Time Stealer, Toyotomi Ami, Tragic Vision, William Angus, Blake Barrows, and Edward Darrow.